Up next from the Stanford Social Innovation Review, McKinsey & Company director Bill Meehan gives advice on how to make online philanthropic markets work.
On Social Innovation Conversations. Hi, I'm Eric Nee, the managing editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
And I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're bringing you a new presentation in the Stanford Social Innovation Review Talks series. Stanford Social Innovation Review provides leaders in the nonprofit, government, and business sectors with the ideas, tools, and skills needed to solve social problems. For more information, visit us online at ssireview.org.
And now, here is our presentation in the Stanford Social Innovation Review Talk Series.
First of all, I'd like to welcome you to Stanford. Your gathering here is a small but important piece in the history of philanthropy, which has been around in the U.S. for less than a century in its current form, and in many of the countries in which you live and operate, not even close to that. It's also a piece of history for the internet and for social entrepreneurship, which are, well, by my measure, maybe a decade or two old. A gathering such as this of the leaders of online giving requires a coming together not only of those three forces, philanthropy, internet, social entrepreneurship, but also of globalization, and mostly, as I look around, and a generational shift in values. And all of that is worth, to me, pointing out and celebrating. So I enter these remarks with that very much on my mind. Before I introduce myself a little bit, let me briefly tell you what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to leave some time, of course, for discussion and questions and answers at the end. I'm going to start by giving a very idiosyncratic personal history of online giving. I make no claims to fact or accuracy, except I think I'm going to capture the essence of how we all got to where we are here today. And then I'll talk something about the opportunities and challenges we face in making online giving markets successful on a large scale, some important elements that are already happening in what you're doing, and other elements which are just on the other side of that tipping point. My purpose today is both to inspire you, but also to challenge you in your important work. My standard, as I'm sure we all share, is a standard of genuine, sustained impact in our communities. And I think we all need to acknowledge there still is much to do by that standard. My own history, briefly, I have been a consultant at McKinsey for 30 years, a typical corporate consultant mostly. I've taught the nonprofit strategy course here at the business school and going on 11 years. I've got what you might say for a U.S. citizen, a typical range of nonprofit experience. Most notably for today, I've been on the GuideStar board since pretty close to the beginning. While I'm not chair today, I've been chair for probably three quarters of GuideStar's history. We all have our reasons for being here and committed to online giving and the market that is part of that. I want to start out by sharing two personal stories which tell you what my reasons are. First, January 1974. As I look around, there's a half a dozen of you who might remember January 1974. I was a senior at Columbia. I had decided earlier in the year not to become a PhD in comparative literature. It was January. I was taking one independent seminar. That was it, and James Joyce and Ezra Pound. I was beginning to think about how I might support myself in the short term. I was walking across South Field, which, if you've ever been to Columbia, is that big field there. I bumped into a good friend, Steve Seidel, and he mentioned he was working as a researcher for a management consulting firm. I didn't know what a management consulting firm was in 1974. He said he was doing research there related to developing roles for older people at the Edna McConnell Clark Foundation, and that the guy he was working for could probably use more help. Two nights later, I was eating in a Brazilian restaurant in Midtown Manhattan with Bill Drayton. I want to share a couple of my Bill Drayton stories. I've got dozens. So a few months later, I'd been working for Bill for many intense 60-hour weeks. I asked him in a quiet moment what he was. He was, of course, at the time an associate at McKinsey. He was a graduate of Harvard, Yale Law School, Oxford. But he was a unique person, to say the least. And I just couldn't figure out who this guy was, in my view. "I'm a public sector entrepreneur," he said. This was 1974. A couple years later, he changed the title to social entrepreneur. He founded Ashoka. He created a new profession called social entrepreneurship. Think about the impact of all of that today. I have some students here, and I see lots of people in their 20s. Many of them went home one Thanksgiving and said to their parents in response to the question, "What are you going to be?" And they said, "I'm going to be a social entrepreneur." And because of Bill Drayton and many others like him, those parents said, "Oh." And then went and told their parents that their kid was going to be a social entrepreneur. That's actually quite a big impact. One quick Drayton story, which is really off the whole point, but it's just a story that means a lot to me. I was having another dinner in a Brazilian restaurant in Midtown Manhattan with Bill. You ate dinner in Indian restaurants, Brazilian restaurants, never cheeseburgers. I was trying to figure out, again, sort of what he was all about. If you've ever met or seen Bill speak, he's understated, sort of Anglo-eccentric kind of guy. And I said, "Bill, you just seem different from anybody else I've ever met." As if at the age of 22 I had some standard to judge Bill. He looked at me in that slightly bewildered way and he said, "Bill, when I was very young, I figured out that if I was going to be the best at something, I was going to be different than everybody else. If I was going to be the best at something, it meant I was going to be different than anybody else." I suspect that remark resonates with some of you. So that was my introduction to social entrepreneurship and nonprofits, change and innovation in the social sector. Now let me fast forward to 1995. I'd been at McKinsey for 15 or 18 years. One day my classmate and close friend from Stanford Business School, Buzz Schmidt, came to see me at the Bank of America building in San Francisco. He had an idea. By the way, this is my 30th reunion from the Stanford Business School week, so don't I look young for that? Buzz had devoted his career to basically nonprofits and philanthropy, and he had an idea. He said, "You know, the IRS every year gets millions of sheets of paper, these Form 990s, and when they receive them, they put them in boxes and they ship them to a warehouse in Maryland. That's what happens to them. I've started an organization to provide that information to the public." If I remember, the beta version was literally looked like yellow pages. It was hardbound telephone book versions. That organization was soon to be called GuideStar, mimicking Morningstar, because in the early days, we thought GuideStar was going to provide ratings or maybe evaluations. Soon, something called the Internet provided GuideStar with a platform to making basic information on nonprofits a reality. And as many of you know now, Buzz has turned his attention to trying to bring that fundamental plank for a robust social sector internationally through GuideStar International. I asked Bob Hottendoff yesterday, the CEO of GuideStar, to give me some dimensions of GuideStar US. 3.5 million unique visitors in 2008, 400,000 unique visitors every month, and GuideStar gets information on 100,000 nonprofits from those nonprofits. And so the nasty rumor that still floats around that GuideStar is a bunch of 990s is long past us. So I could give you lots of exciting and inspiring stories about the beginning of GuideStar. But in essence, GuideStar for the first 5 or 6 years was this. We got paper forms from the IRS. We shipped them sometimes offshore to keyboard digitizers who digitized that information, and we provided it free for people on the Internet. Does that sound not sexy or what? That was the early GuideStar. As many of you, I'm sure, recognize, starting these online giving markets sounds really exciting and sexy, but basically is hard work. The underlying vision that Buzz had, I assert, is not that different from any of yours. Donors and volunteers need basic information on social organizations or nonprofits. They need to know their missions. They need to know something about their finances. They need to know what initiatives or projects are underway. Maybe they even know whether the thing's having any impact. Second, donors and volunteers need some evaluation. More than just information, but answers to questions. Is this organization effective and efficient? Compared to what? How do I actually know? And third, donors and volunteers need some way to reach those organizations in what in the early days I called the proxy marketplace, meaning something which serves the function of markets, bringing buyers and sellers, donors and organizations together. Those three elements, information, evaluation, and some proxy marketplace, are still the key elements, I think, for online giving markets today. I just want to spend a couple minutes underscoring the importance of what I call the proxy marketplace and what more recently I've taken to calling the social capital markets, which is a term that people seem to like. The social capital markets are where donors and other funders, sometimes assisted by intermediaries, come to make their social investments. Is the social capital market today efficient in the economic sense, not just in the narrow cost sense? Is the online giving marketplace efficient? These are questions you all should be asking yourself literally every day. Markets of any kind have four characteristics. First is cost efficiency. Efficient markets have low transaction costs. In commercial markets, those transaction costs are often less than 1%. Sometimes they're more. In the U.S., where we have the best data, it is not unusual for a nonprofit to spend 10, 20, or 30% of their money raising social capital. A second characteristic of efficient markets, and certainly of efficient social capital markets, is a robust information flow with data on value and risk that is available, that is up to date. A third characteristic is that it results in value-driven allocation. Buyers or investors reward better performers and do not reward lesser performers. And finally, an efficient market is flexible. Transactions can be made flexibly, quickly, and easily. I pose each of you this core question. Does your online giving market meet those four tests? Is it cost efficient? Is there a robust information flow? Does it result in donors making value-driven allocations? And are the transactions flexible, quick, and easy? I think those are important questions. It may even be the basis of your next offsite. So let me return to my personalized eccentric history. Hopefully a little bit it'll be entertaining, at least to the one or two of you who were there. But I also want to lay the groundwork for some lessons learned for the future. Show of hands. Who remembers charitableway.com? Okay, Pete Montanus, charitableway.com. Have any of you ever considered making your .org a .com? Show of hands. Okay. Have any of you fantasized about getting really wealthy by doing good? Well, we have some honest people. With the dawn of the internet, there was a frenzy. Peter, you remember very well. There was a frenzy of startup activity in the .org space. Multiple online giving versions. In the meeting yesterday, people said, do we have too many brands? Do we have too many whatever? Well, you know, I don't think you have as many today as you had in 1999. And it was just a frenzy. It was the bubble internet frenzy, and it was in the .org space, too. I remember hosting a meeting at Wilson Sonsini, which, for those of you who don't know, is the Silicon Valley startup IPO.com law firm, with Buzz Schmidt at GuideStar, Jay Backstrand, who is here today, from then a volunteer match, and some guy named Dave, who had a payments and fulfillment platform. There are always a lot of guys named Dave who have online giving platforms that you can use. We were going to have a .com and a .org, in part because Bill Gates Sr. had told us at GuideStar, you should be a for-profit business. I was embarrassed within months to organize that meeting. Thank God those social entrepreneurs had some sense. And I'm even more embarrassed now to think back on it. At the time, Pete Montanus was the wizard. Funded, I think, do you remember how much it was, Peter? Was it like $8 million or $12 million? Some by Benchmark Capital, which was then, Benchmark was the eBay firm, right? Benchmark was the hot venture capital firm, and they were funding an online giving marketplace, charitableway.com. Charitableway.com was Oz. It was, in its first version, an online giving market before Network for Good. Transactions fees would pave the road to Oz. Getting rich by doing good. It seemed too good to be true. Remember this for later. If you build it, will they come? Not this time. Later, charitableway.com tried to morph its way into an enterprise platform for corporations and United Ways for online giving. Anyone who's ever tried to walk down that path and sell those kinds of platforms to corporate enterprises and United Ways know that when death finally comes, you welcome it because it's the... because it's the end of a very painful process. So at this point, you might be asking, Bill, well, when did the fun start? When did finally things come together? Didn't GuideStar and Volunteer Match and Network for Good survive and thrive from this part of the era of the internet? So let me introduce you to a third visionary hero after Bill Drayton and Buzz Schmidt, and that's Joel Fleischman, now as then a professor at Duke, but then also the president of Atlantic Philanthropies, who had for 10 years a program area specifically in supporting the building of infrastructure for philanthropy and nonprofits. I will skip the long story, but simply saying that GuideStar, Volunteer and Match, and Network for Good got much of their early stage financing from a syndicate led by Joel and Atlantic, Hewlett, Kellogg, several others were part of it. In GuideStar's case, I think we got $12 or $15 million. Absent that risk-taking, we'd likely have essentially nothing to show from that era. No GuideStar, no Network for Good, no Volunteer Match. So that's enough of my history. Here's the lessons learned, and I think there are three. First, even with the strong undercurrents of social entrepreneurship, the internet, desire for transparency in the social sector, great innovations don't just happen. Visionary entrepreneurs and visionary funders were needed and are needed, and they must persist through many obstacles. Online giving as a major force was not a preordained phenomena, and it still isn't. Second, online giving has been searching for over a decade for a robust business model. We have learned many things that don't work, at least .com in the charitableway.com sense. And we've discovered that there are certain things that are smaller ideas than we had hoped, like donations as merchandising. But are we prepared to sit here today and say that we have discovered a robust online giving market model? Third, lesson learned, if we build it, a few will come. But just enough to pay a few bills, make a few donations, but not enough to have widespread, systemic, large-scale impact on the social sector, its our communities, and the organizations within it. So those are my three lessons learned from what now is probably 13 years of history. Let me turn to where I think we are today. And the answer is at the beginning. Maybe the end of the beginning, but at the beginning. Let me throw out a few numbers. Please feel free to shout out corrections or additions if you have different or better numbers. Network for Good I think, is the online giving market that has raised and distributed the most money, as best as I can tell. I have one estimate of $86 million. By the end of 2005, $175 million as of today. Anyone want to dispute that? I actually think the biggest online giving market, by some definition, is what used to be called eWay, which is the back end for some United Ways and other charities, which I think has done well over $1 billion, but let's call it Network for Good. That $175 million for Network for Good includes Katrina and a couple of major Asian disasters, and they've raised $175 million. I have Mission Fish at just over $100 million. Is that close? First Giving at $70 million. Donors Choose at about $24 million. Kiva at close to $50 million. Any other numbers anyone would cite? So that's the scale of it. Now, we all understand and should not in any way make light of the reason we're all doing this in the end is to touch any individual life in an important way. And by any measures, millions are a lot of money, particularly if you're in a country with no culture of philanthropy and giving, and you're trying to build that culture. But let's benchmark that. According to the New York Times, Barack Obama raised $28 million online in January. Let's look at total U.S. philanthropy. We all know the numbers, $300 billion annually, about $225 billion to individuals. Let's take off a third that goes just to churches. We're touching far less, U.S., globally, however you want to count it, far less than 1% of charitable giving. So what are the implications of that history as well as our current position? Let me offer you three opportunities, challenges, or as Lloyd would call it, demands. First, online giving as a phenomena has yet to address its core strategic challenge. You've yet to address the core strategic question. Essentially, we are a new paradigm 2.0 business model faced with an old paradigm, 1.0 donor mindset and set of behaviors. In some countries, you're probably donor mindset 0.1. You're still trying to build that culture. The simple fact is, and you all know this, is that most, in fact, if you round up, virtually all charitable donations are raised in response to a request, not made as a result of a donor's proactive, thoughtful investment. If you want to quibble with that, fine. Maybe you'll get to 2%. An efficient mechanism where donors come to make their charitable investment decisions based on information and evaluation is still largely a vision in search of a paradigm shift in donor behavior. I wish it wasn't so, but I still think it is. I do think that the business model that many of you adopted, Donors Choose, Kiva, Global Giving, many of you others, has made an important step forward. It makes the usually complex step of evaluation simple by providing prepackaged, easy-to-understand, trustworthy products that donors can support without a lot of outcomes analysis or comparing one organization to another. I think it's a big step forward. As a model to collect lots of relatively small donation, it appears to be working quite well, and I think it's just the beginning. But for potentially large investors and donors, the evaluation process remains hard, complex, and essentially without guideposts. Until we come up with a new paradigm for that, the old paradigm of charitable giving, largely being driven by marketing and development, will remain. And that frames, I think, your second challenge or opportunity for online giving markets, the hope that it is a field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. But in fact, we know, even with natural disasters, even with the most powerful public influencer in the U.S., Oprah, we're still less than 1% of charitable giving. Given that we are at Stanford in the Arriaga Alumni Center, let me ask you the following question. Stanford is in the middle of its capital campaign. It's probably going to raise $5 billion, almost $1 billion a year. Does anyone want to guess how many people work in the development department of Stanford University? 300? Over 400 people. I wonder whether all online giving markets worldwide have 400 employees. You certainly don't have 400 marketing and development professionals. That's what it takes to raise $1 billion a year. And this is the high, high end. So your second question is, since if you build it, only a few will come, how are you going to drive traffic to your site? We need an answer that is one or two or three orders of magnitude larger than whatever we're doing today. Your third challenge or opportunity is to ensure that you are truly adding value by having clear, even measurable impact. We all talk about it, and that's virtually all we do. Simply being a simple, neutral pass-through payment mechanism, while useful, is not enough. Your business model must intrinsically, in some way, result in value-added allocation decisions. I can see two possible approaches. There probably are others. One approach is to be able to demonstrate that through some mechanism of explicit evaluation, I happen to think that, you know, what they do for colleges and universities in the U.S. is not half bad, that better organizations are receiving more from you and worse organizations are receiving less because of the structure of your online giving market. Much of the infrastructure, quite frankly, both intellectual and practical, has yet to be built. I was amused in preparing for today. I was surfing many of your sites. At least one of you showed prominently at the bottom of your front page that you were proudly a Charity Navigator 4-star site. We at GuideStar view Charity Navigator as a bad compromise. Generalized ratios of inconsistent data to make overly broad conclusions. It's also pretty much current state of the art. The second approach to adding value to donors and investment decisions would be to have so much volume that the wisdom of crowds phenomena that we can see in more efficient markets comes into play. That would require not only a huge increase in transactions in online giving markets, but transparency of those transactions so others could benefit from the information to be gleaned from their decisions. So I leave you with those three challenges and opportunities: creating a new paradigm for donors, drawing an order of magnitude more donor transactions to your sites, and in the end, being sure that you're actually adding value. I know you'll find them demanding and challenging. I know that I'm inspired by the efforts you're making, and I actually have complete confidence that some or all of you will get there in the end. Thank you very much. Questions, comments, challenges, discussion items? Yes.
I was one of the persons who raised the hand when you asked William if we want to become rich by doing good. But this is a different kind of wealth. We are redefining wealth now, and that would be another challenge for us. Now we are not measuring the wealth by the size of our bank accounts, of the number of cars that we have, but how healthy are our relationships in our families, in our communities. Because how do we measure the value of a smile? How do we measure the value of changing a member of our community that is reformed and that is no longer a criminal? How do we measure teaching from one of our professors that will stay for the rest of our lives? How do we measure inspiration? And being here at Stanford is very encouraging to see all these people that we are, you know, we're in that path. And here also was born the Institute, Martin Luther King Institute for Nonviolence. And Martin Luther King said, we have to evolve from thing-oriented civilization into a community-oriented civilization. So besides being in the material world, offering shoes and offering books and offering clothing, what if we also volunteered like Kiva, like being the cause and offering our time and offering our compassion? that those things cannot be measured but are very, very powerful. So that would be another challenge for us to redefine wealth and be the cause. Thank you for asking that. I'm a scientist, so I always appreciate the challenge of, you know, critical thinking. So thank you for asking that.
Thank you. And I'm not sure I can do anything but applaud and celebrate the values that you're espousing.
Thank you for your talk. I'm Kath Delaney with Madeira Group. My question is, a lot of the NGOs that we work with, a lot of our board and advisors are of an other generation, if you will, and a lot of our staff and users are from a younger generation. How do we bring our board and advisors along to understand the user experience and the technology?
Don't. I'm hardly an expert. I think technology is a generational phenomena, and by time for the generation who is going to be most comfortable with this technology to use it. Now, having said that, I do much of my charitable giving through Schwab online. And so I suspect that there are, I don't know what we want to describe as the older generation, but amongst the older generation who, while they may not be on Facebook, they're doing some things online. And you could make the experience real for them, even if they're not necessarily going to use it for them, by relating to some other way that they're currently on the web.
Thank you.
I was interested in your comments about a 1.0 culture meeting a 2.0 environment such as we have here, particularly with regard to issues of creating a culture, building more with a donor culture, and especially given your comments about Charity Navigator. Could you share some thoughts that you have, things that you see promising with regard to developing social investment criteria and other evaluative models for what people are more and more trying to call investment rather than giving?
Can I use the performance measurement term? So I think the best case that there's progress on performance measurement is we have so many smart, dedicated people who seem to want to solve the problem. And I think we're beginning to draw in some new minds. So at Stanford, both with the Center for Social Innovation and something called the Center for Philanthropy for Civil Society, and in places like Duke and Harvard, we're beginning to get some of the best academic thinking into the performance measurement issue. The last great thing any of us have read about real performance measurement of a social sector organization was, there really isn't very much. And I'm a proponent, as some of you know, of the following view. I quote Einstein, which is, not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. And if Einstein stumbled on this one, it might be because it's a hard problem. And to me, the black and white thought for the sector is, let's just be clear on a few simple things to measure. How many kids came to your reading program? What were the improvements of their reading score and the improvements in their high school graduation rates? How much did it cost you per capita? And give me the same measures for three organizations that you compare yourself to. And let's not have some philosophical debate whether the reading score is a good number or not. Let's just give me those goddamn numbers. And I don't want to talk about self-esteem or pulling people out of poverty. It's too complicated. I'm sure somebody will figure that out, but it's not going to happen. And so I think the sector would be well served to focus on inputs and outputs that we could all agree are incomplete but important. Leave the philosophical questions for another time. I think if we just made progress on that, it would be huge. Meanwhile, most of us, all of us, when we give money to charities, don't even ask to see the stuff. And notwithstanding a community-oriented world, until donors demand measurement, the sector will not provide it. I wish it wasn't true, but so far, I think it is.
I'm on the board of a nonprofit called Water Partners that It's bringing clean water and sanitation to those in developing countries who don't have it. And up until now, we've had a pretty traditional web presence and pretty traditional fundraising. And, you know, there are a number of people who believe that kind of the whole Web 2.0, we ought to be jumping in with an online marketplace and doing kind of more in that area. And I think it's been my perception that it's something that we, you know, just have to do with where things are going. It's interesting hearing your talk and kind of pointing out some of the big challenges. And I guess the question is how risky do you think it is? Do you think it is a no-brainer for nonprofits to jump into this? You know, just kind of curious, is it something you're kind of, it's very early in the process, and so just curious if you have...
So the short answer is I wouldn't be speaking here unless I was hugely supportive of the role in the internet for nonprofits generally and in online giving in the broadest sense of the word. There will be a tipping point, there will be a breakthrough. At some point in the future, much of the business of the nonprofit sector will be conducted on the internet. I have no question. And if every nonprofit I'm involved in, I would definitely encourage to have some sensible online presence. And everybody ought to have a donate button everywhere they can have it. And I'm hoping that that will spawn some breakthrough innovation, which others can then quickly follow. So I'm absolutely supportive for nonprofits to have an important web presence, not the least of which that for the young generation, which just because of the way things work, are not going to have a lot of money for a while, but that, you know, as we all know, their world is very much a world of the internet.
Thanks very much, Bill.
All right, thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation from Stanford Social Innovation Review. Stanford Social Innovation Review provides leaders in the nonprofit, government, and business sectors with the ideas, tools, and skills needed to solve social problems. For more information, visit us online at ssireview.org.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Jeff Kirkland. Our website editor was Marguerite Rigoglioso. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.